Welcome to the Saturday, August 5th, 2017 meeting of the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission. Before we get into the agenda item number 17, open public input, it's both a pleasure and a sad moment for all of us here that we're bidding adieu to one of our colleagues, Miranda Wecker, JD, and Miranda was on when I joined, and she was one of the first persons I interacted with, and it's been a great relationship that we've had during my tenure here, and speaking professionally, I'm going to miss her expertise, her passion, her understanding and compassion, and personally, I'm going to miss seeing a friend once a month that we can have a beer together and some tuna and tell stories about all sorts of other things. Miranda's husband went to was the same program at University of Michigan that I went through, so we always have this little go blue moment too, which is a requirement. But I thought what we would do is everybody having an opportunity to say a few words, commissioners, and before we get underway with that, Miranda, I have a few presentations that I wanted to present. This is an envelope without a stamp. So that is for a tuna fishing trip. We didn't pick the day or the time because that's, you know, you have to do all that. But that should buy you a case of Starkus if you don't get out. And a card of appreciation from the commission. And a certificate of appreciation from the commission.
Thank you.
And do you want to do your...
Yeah. Sure, yeah. Joe, why don't you help? We have a couple items for you, Miranda. First off, we have a plaque, and this says, Miranda Wecker, Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission, in deep appreciation for your 12 years of service to the citizens of Washington State. Thank you, Director and staff. And I'd just like to say, in my experience, you're one of the hardest working commissioners I've been around, so thank you very much. And that includes, you know, 30 years in Idaho. You really go the extra mile. I know you care about sportsmen and all fishermen, and so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, wow.
And we have...
So, Miranda, this is a duck stamp print.
Oh, wow.
And it's from 2005, which was the year that you first started with the commission.
Oh, that's cool.
And so we wanted to give you that, and I just wanted to say thank you, too. When I came on board, you were here, had been here a couple of years. It's been great to work with and a mentor, and I just really appreciate the time I've spent with you.
So, yeah, those are even sea ducks that you see.
Yes,
so I thought, Miranda, we would start.
No.
You almost say nice things. Yeah.
So if we could just go along and everybody take an opportunity.
She's always telling me I'm rough on the outside with a heart and I don't want to prove her right. So
notice the Kleenex.
I'm going to defer to Jay. I'll talk to her on the phone a lot.
But Miranda was here when I got here, and this was a big, confusing place to be, and she really just, I don't know, exemplifies what this work is and what the dedication it takes. And she was a great mentor to me, and I always remember when I went to go before my hearing before the Senate, you know, I was nervous, and she just told me what it was going to be like. She said, it's going to be awful. Will grill you. This doesn't, and she says, none of it matters. Don't get upset. Don't answer back nasty. It's just a process, you know. And it was exactly that way. And I don't know how many times during that hearing I was biting my lip, going, "It's just a process. It's just a process." So you really help us, I think, learn how to serve on this commission, and you'll be greatly missed. And you're a good mentor, a good friend, and you've been an outstanding commissioner. So.
I have to respond, though, Jay, because that is not what I said. I did not say it was meaningless. I got to go on the record. What I said was you have to respect the process.
Yes, respect
you have
the
to process. Respect the senators. They're going to ask you tough questions. That's their job, but you got to respect the process. Show them you respect them. That's what I told
you. You're still mentoring. You're still mentoring, Miranda.
So TBW, pull the tape.
Well, no, that was a very good little interchange that what I was going to say as the very, by a long shot, newest commissioner with not the background in fish that I would have liked to had when I came in here. Miranda was already legendary, and I had heard of her for years working with the legislature because you were very active there. But the things that I heard was that she's tough, she knows what she's talking about, and that people respect her. And if you get, if you happen to say something that isn't quite what she agrees with, you'll be corrected respectfully. And that's the word that matters here. The other thing that I want to, this is kind of at my peril, there's a gendered thing in this commission, and being a woman in a very much male-dominated field, you have to learn to take it. And occasionally, it used to be more rough and tumble, basically in all of the places that we interact. But now, if there's any ounce of that of gender politics come out, it would be more likely to be kind of getting patted on the head. And I would bet that that's happened to you once or twice in your tenure, and I would feel a little bad for the people who did that.
So, I got their new haircut.
So I would like to say that you are a good role model, both in terms of your knowledge and your values and your respect and your ability to function quite well, thank you, in a field that is still dominated by the other gender. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you. And I love that comment. Because, yeah, there were times when I was patted on the head and told how to vote. Mm-hmm. And that didn't go over. That is just not what I expected. And on the commission, I knew I was here to do a job, to use my own brain. So I did not appreciate being told how to vote. It did the opposite. And so you're absolutely right. But I also had a thought this morning, Barbara, that if you stay on the commission as long as I have, it will be 2029.
Oh, don't even say that.
You're off. That's unimaginable.
You'll
to
be
me.
50.
Yeah, I'll be middle-aged by then.
I can't even imagine what the world will be like at 29.
That's what's good about these overlaps for all of us, because we learn from each other.
Well, I told a story last night at dinner. I was at my very first commission meeting, and it was time for a lunch break, and I didn't know anything about where I was, what I was doing. And, you know, Miranda does have a reputation for being tough, but she's also very sensitive, and she saw that look in my eye and took me out to lunch that first day and made me feel comfortable, and has gone to great lengths to help bring me up to speed on the issues that we deal with in the commission level. And a lot of the blue sheets I know had intent of just learning and to the benefit of all of us. And we're in a cycle right now of losing a lot of experience. We see that in the department. Every day we see retirement notices, and we're losing huge numbers of very highly experienced people. And Miranda is one of those examples of 12 years of experience is going away, and that cannot be replaced. And it is my hope, Miranda, that you'll continue to answer your phone and emails.
I always do.
And continue to contribute. And thank you so much, myself, and I hope there's a time that the people of the state of Washington will appreciate your contribution to Fish and Wildlife during your tenure.
Thanks.
So the first commission meeting I ever attended, you were chair. I loved it. Another gender reference. There you were. Guys on each side. Madam Chair. So when I joined the commission, Brad was still Madam Chair.
I'm still a therapist. Yeah.
And it made sense. Well, I'm referring to Miranda's tenure. Calm down.
You're in prescription now.
Miranda, the word mentor has come up. Certainly it applies. I appreciate it. You and I have had our struggles.
Yes, we've differed.
but I think we've worked out a great relationship, and I honor the service that you've given and also our relationship. So thanks.
Thank you so much.
Folks haven't left me a lot to say, but I'll find something. But I, it was intimidating, you know, to get a call one evening from the governor's office and say, hey, Larry, you're on a commission. And so then you start getting paperwork and emails, and you go to your first meeting. And the first meeting, of course, there were some other commissioners on here, and Miranda was chair, and nobody handed me a handbook. I mean, there's no handbook given out on what's what you're supposed to do, what some of the protocols are. But I'll tell you, this lady to my right, she has got it going on. I don't think there's anything that she forgets. She's never been intimidating to me. She's been always helpful. I'll tell you what, if I had to go to war, I'd have Miranda hooked to my hip. I'll tell you what.
Wait a second. I don't know.
Anyway, what an amazing person, and what an honor to work with her for these 5 years that I have. The rest of us have a lot of heavy lifting to do to try and continue to get the work done because of her tenacity, attention to detail, and can-do attitude. And one of the things that I nicknamed her must have been about 3 or 4 years ago, and it speaks to how she always keeps us out of trouble, more so me than others, trying to learn some of the protocols. And during one of the meetings, I nicknamed her the Queen of Process, because we have our lawyer in the back here, and we have things that we can do and can't do and not supposed to do it. And she kept it always, always flowing correctly. And it's been such a pleasure, and I'm going to miss you, but I'm going to be in touch with you.
Yes, absolutely.
So, thank you, Miranda.
We are all sharing our own anecdotes, and I do remember when I came on the commission, you know, and I had been active to some degree before the commission, while you were a member, and but I came on, and there was no kind of there's no doubt about, you know, kind of my the reason I was appointed was to bring more of a commercial fishing interest to the table, which was I think lacking. So when I came on, you were on the fish committee and you were the chair, and I asked to be on the fish committee, and you gave up your spot to do that. So I am appreciative of that, and that was a good gesture, and I'll always remember that. The other thing, too, Miranda, is you know, you and I have we've disagreed on issues, some issues, very profound disagreements, but you've always been cordial, and I will always kind of admire you for your ability to kind of work with others, influence others. And so even though we've been, you know, on opposite sides of many issues, I can still say that I admire your talents, your hard work, your work ethic, and not only a command of the process, but also a command of the substance, too. And that's a rare combination. So any event. We'll miss you, and I'm sure we'll see you. Was that the 3 minute? Yeah. Okay.
I'm good. Just right here.
That is great. No, that is hilarious. Thank you, Bob. Wow. That is so significant to me. That is so touching to me, because this is the essence of America and democracy, is people getting together and disagreeing amicably and understanding your point of view is not the only one. There's other legitimate points of view, giving them respect, trying to find some way of getting along and moving forward for the benefit of the resources. So I'm very, very touched, particularly by the sentiment of the people who I disagreed with. That's the essence. That's what's great about our country. And it's also what's great about the commission process. I had some thoughts that I wanted to share this last opportunity, if I can get through it without being emotional. It's crazy that you get emotional about a job that you're finishing up, but it happens. I've seen it happen to other people. It's wild. I mean, it's happening to me. But I do want to say that I am a believer in the commission as the way to manage, to oversee, to direct, to provide policy for the department. It's a way of doing it that's unique and unusual in state government. Most of the time, the governor's in charge and makes the higher-level decisions. But the people, through the referendum, I guess it was, decided Washington State should have a commission with teeth. The teeth part is the ability to hire and fire the director. That's where we get leverage over the real performance, the real activities of the department. And you got to take that responsibility seriously, because we're it. The commission is the only body that supervises, that has the power to change the behavior of the department. And otherwise, you know, the director is completely free of any supervision. So, and I'm a believer in the process that the people, by a large majority, put into place, giving that power to our commission. Not every commission across this nation has that kind of power, but it is important, I think, because it does give us real serious leverage. And what are we doing here? We're being the voice of the people. Why did the people want us in this powerful position? Because they care so deeply about the future of the resources, about conservation, and making sure that politics is removed to a certain extent. You can't remove it entirely. We're all adults. We know that. But because the resources are so important, conservation cannot be traded off for petty politics. It just shouldn't ever be. That's what this is about. And that's what I tried to be about. You can hear it when people testify, the passion, the effort they show to come here and stand up in public and do what's so scary, which is testifying before us. That it shows just how much this matters in a unique way to people. And it matters to me. That's why I'm here, spending my time. 10 cents an hour. Isn't that what we get? 10 cents an hour.
Not that much.
So it's been a privilege. You hear that? That's a cliche, but it's true. It's a privilege to be a decision maker, to be challenged by having 9 others to try to reach agreement with. You can't control any of these people. They're all independent, distinguished individuals who came to the attention of the governor's office, and that's why they're here. So I guess I've said a lot of what I intended to say. I had a series of bullets. Here's some of parting wisdoms, words of wisdom. Respect all views.
I think when you go to law school, you get the kind of training to understand that everybody deserves an advocate. Everybody's position is worthy of a defense. So you learn to get into other people's shoes. Respect all views. Insist on civility. I tried to do that as chair. When people started showing their anger and being uncivil, nasty, I stopped them because that was wrong. That's not what we want in governance. Resist pettiness. Resist petty politics. Hold firm to what is right. Keep your moral compass and demand accountability. That's what we're here for. So I leave with tremendous gratitude for the opportunity I had. It's just been a great ride. Challenging, I've grown. I've discovered elements of myself. And I guess the last thing I want to say, I shared this with my husband, and I think it's really there's all kinds of useful life skills, but I call it the super polite shtick. It's always been effective for me when dealing with people who are angry. It's, you know, just be polite. Try to be overly polite. It drops some of the temperature. So I think that's the last little bit of wisdom. Thank you so much for all your kind words.
Thank you. And I know we have Deputy Chief Sensi wanted to say a few words, so you want to come up here, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I struggle through this, I want to make sure everybody understands that some of the terms I may use are gender neutral. And I was at a Ducks Unlimited banquet a number of years ago, and a small Israeli guy, ex-Mossad, was standing behind me, and I was in the food line. And I was talking to people and taking my time navigating this food line, and he got frustrated, and he tapped me on the shoulder, and he said, "My God, man, lead, follow, or get the hell out of the way, but do something." Do something. And to do something as a commissioner takes an incredible amount of courage. A commissioner is a composite of all of us. Sportsmen, women, small business owner, educator, scientist, someone that's just simply passionate for our outdoor heritage or our natural use heritage and a quality of life that we all enjoy here in our very, very great state. What is a commissioner? Someone that somehow has to balance all that passion with conservation and the needs of people. With regard to something that is limited, it's extremely limited. There's not enough, and all of us want more of it. A commissioner has to be such a diplomat that all the differences can be settled so that each side thinks they won. If a commissioner takes no action, he or she is indifferent. If he or she takes a position, it's part of a special interest. There's an agenda. If he's understanding, he takes the wrong side. If he doesn't, he isn't supportive. He must make hard decisions, or she must make hard decisions, on the best available science, which, as you all know, oftentimes is incomplete. Sometimes it's our best guess rather than the best available science. But it's the best that we have. If you make a decision based on that, you're reckless. And if you don't, you're punting. The bottom line is, you can't win. You have one of the most difficult, one of the most challenging roles that I can think of. what you do takes a lot of courage, and the fact that you do it for 10 cents an hour is just incredible. Because I know that your decisions take an emotional toll. I know that they're evaluated, they're scrutinized, they're second-guessed. And because of your passion for the quality of life that we have here in the state of Washington, you take that to heart. And it has an impact. So I want you to know, for whatever it's worth, the men and women that serve in uniform in this great state that protect your fish and wildlife management strategies appreciate this entire group, and they've appreciated your leadership, and they've appreciated your support of fish and wildlife police officers that face many of the same challenges and many of the same attitudes that you do. So I have a couple of things that I wanted to give you. Can I approach, sir?
As I say, you got the gun, you can do whatever you want.
It hasn't been loaded since I came to headquarters. This is a really cool coffee cup that we just got.
Oh, cool.
Okay, limited edition. No, not really, but they're going fast. I had a bunch in my office, and they've been stolen by many captains and sergeants and officers, and I wanted you to have one before we didn't have any.
Does that work for tea, Mike?
Sir?
Does that work for tea?
It does work for tea.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
I
it
drink
is
both.
A hot beverage cup, not a coffee cup.
Yeah. But would a beverage with ice cubes fit in it?
Sir, you can put anything in it that you want.
Better get Brad one.
I also wanted to, I got authorization from the chief who couldn't be here today. I wanted to give you a chief's coin. And this is not just a trinket. We don't give this to just anybody. excuse me. So the history behind these coins began in World War I. They were intended to identify people with a unit. And so hold that thought. I present you with a plaque, which makes you an honorary Fish and Wildlife Police Officer.
That's beautiful.
And I might have it backwards. Yeah. I don't have my glasses on. So in deep appreciation for your work here, your service here, your role on the Enforcement Committee, your support to the challenges that we face, and your problem-solving skills, thank you so much for your service.
If I could add just one thing really quick, Commissioner Baker, you said it on the way up here, role model. For me, you're a role model for all of us, so thank you for your service.
Just one other quick thing. That Chief's coin will not get you out of speeding tickets.
Nor any crabs that you
know.
Yes. Yeah.
Hey. Yep.
Thank you,
Brenda. Thank you. Boy. I love you guys. I remember when I first was invited, Mike Sensi lives across the river from me. And when I first joined the commission, I had met Mike. He'd worked with my husband in law enforcement. So I knew what a fabulous job he was doing in Willapa Bay, which was a pretty rough place to do enforcement. And he invited me over to his house for a barbecue with some of the other enforcement guys. And so I drove up to his house, and there was all these uniformed officers and trucks. And I hadn't been in that context before, but they were so welcoming. It opened my eyes to the job that they do. Over the years, I have gotten it. I mean, I used to worry when my husband would go out to do enforcement because it's dangerous, and you never know what's going to happen. So on a very personal level, I know the risks that they take.
and have appreciated that maybe more than others do. Getting emotional, but thank you so much. I love you guys.
You gonna wrap it up for us?
No, but I there again,
we're all commission members, and there's somebody that's an integral part of our commission that may or may not want to say something.
I can't.
I wouldn't function without her, so I just wanted to make certain she had the opportunity. She wanted to say something.
I'm still going to be your friend.
No.
I don't know why we're doing this.
It's not a wake.
No, but Tammy, if you wanted to, need the opportunity.
We'll talk.
We will talk.
Yeah. Tammy and I are.
Absolutely.
Okay. I will move on then. Thank you all. And getting into item number 17, open public input. We have about six or eight, and everybody I think knows the rules of engagement here, so I'll call you up two at a time. Joe and Wayne Klein, please.
Good morning, Commission and Directors. My name is Joe Verdos, Puget Sound shrimp fisherman, Anacortes, Washington. And I'd like to take this opportunity to take you on a virtual tour of Highway 20 from Burlington to Keystone. And I'm trying to channel Garrison Keillor, if you would. Pretend not, put on your NPR glasses and think that you're doing. And what I want to do is demonstrate the importance to a local economy, to the local culture of shrimp per se as a product, as an attraction to tourism, to people who come from Seattle for express purposes to tour the area and just to buy shrimp. So starting in Highway 20 in Burlington, you get off and I forget the exit number, Larry could probably tell me, you run into Skagerson Seafood, which is run by Eric and Tana Skagrud. Eric was a crab fisherman, also Alaska fisherman. And as it says, it's Skagerson and it's local products. And I've known them both. I started Tana out selling coonstripe shrimp myself years ago in the farmer's market in Mount Vernon. She was selling horse things at the Bony Pony at that point, and I said she could do something better and sell some shrimp for me. She did. She's got to the point where she's got a very large store and it's well worth shopping at. If you continue on, you go up the across the Quinn Bridges and you run into Black Rock Seafood, and it's run by a local Yugoslav fisherman family guy named Tony Fernolovich, with a itch name. You can guess there's probably a little bit of commercial fishing in his background. It used to be Tibbetts Crab Market until the Tibbetts retired. It was opened in the 1940s and 50s, and it's been in the Tibbetts family for years. Merle and Lucy were my neighbors, so I bought the property, so I actually own the store, but I bought it as an outlet, as an investment, and continued it going. So people still have the same phone number from 25, 30, 40 years. It's 293-2525, and it's never changed. It's gotten, if you got it in your Rolodex from those years, it still works. You go to Sharp's Corner and you run into Ron's Produce. Ron's relatively new. He's selling shrimp. Kurt and Lori Keller sell it to him, cooked off of the boat, and you will get it there, and you can turn left and go into Oak Harbor if you want there. But if you continue on the highway spur into Anacortes, you'll run into Capsania Marina and Snooky, which is the boat owned by Kurt and Lori Keller, and they will sell it off at B Dock. They'll sell shrimp to you. And on the weekends, they will sell shrimp to you in the Anacortes Farmers Market. So Kurt and Lori are there. This is going to take a little while. I don't know if I'm going to have your...
Not too much longer, Joe.
Okay.
Two are a little short.
Thank you. It's anyway, you get into Strom's Shrimp Shack, which is the original shrimp shack, and the Stroms have the claimed actually being the people who discovered spot prawns in Skagit Valley, and nobody knew spot prawns were out there until the Stroms started bringing it in, and people started sending boats and stuff like that to follow them, found out where they were actually getting these things. A little bit of intrigue there. And you get into Oak Harbor, you have the Waldron's and the Seabolt Seafood Market. And if you get down to the landing at Keystone, you have the Kellison family own the restaurant there and that too. This is all very important. It's all very, the decades and decades of culture of that area, and also brings in a lot of people. Probably is, in a lot of ways, through the years, as much as tulips. It's just spread out over a long period of time. That said, I just want you to enjoy that tour. But more on policy things, when you get into the shrimp briefing, look at page number 9. There's definitely problems in page number 9. The problems with it is that the numbers are incorrect because they're taken from fish tickets, and Bob Sizemore has inherited this graph, so it's not his. It's not his responsibility. But when you get to 2003, you will see that the number says that there's the gross landings was 250,000 pounds, which equals about $33 a pound, which is not correct. And the problems are that fishermen are the buyers and sellers, and that those numbers are grossly inaccurate. It also does not reflect... it does not reflect inflation at all, too. So it's a time-compressed graph, and if I had 10 minutes, I could brief you onto its problems.
Thank you, Joe. The first one on I-20, the seafood store, you know what they got? One of the best things they sell there is not local. Lobster rolls. They do, and it's a really good lobster. I drive down just to have which you can't get in this part of the world. I've never seen, but so that's my commercial plug for them.
Very similar to an East Coast where you drive down the coast and you run into all these different seafood stands. Skagit Valley is like an East Coast, but it's just not lobster generally, it's shrimp.
Mostly. I always joke with them is that they say it's all local stuff, and I say, what part of the locality is it? Okay, thank you. Kerry Stratton and Wayne.
Good morning, Commissioners. Director Miranda, thanks for your service, and you've been a great friend to recreational fishermen, and I want you to know I'll share the water with you anytime. Which brings me to the problem. The water's closed. The game fish season seems to be a casualty of declining salmon runs, and there's got to be a way to work this out to where we can keep having these game fish seasons, specifically, in my case, the Skagit River, the cutthroat season, and by extension, the bull trout. I have fished that cutthroat season for 25 years and have never hooked a salmon, not a coho, not a pink, not a chum, never in 25 years. I know the tribes feel there's not any empirical data to gauge the impacts that this cutthroat fishery might have, so in the face of no actual data, we have to go with anecdotal data, and that's what I've got. That's my data. And again, I don't know how we're ever going to get any data if we don't have a season to fish and take creel censuses and things like that. So somehow we need to jump out of the box and think a little bit, maybe get a trial season, have some enforcement on the river while they're there, making sure guys aren't fishing for salmon. They can take a creel census. They can roll right up to my boat, ask me how many salmon I hooked and how many cutthroat. But I can tell you once again that the amount of salmon that get hooked by actual cutthroat fishermen is very, very small. In fact, sometimes we catch very few cutthroat. It's fishing after all. And I know in the past, the regulations always said closed to fishing for salmon, and that's always seemed to be sufficient. When that regulation was in effect, you could go on a river, you wouldn't see very many people, if any. There's always the outliers out there, but you know what? They're fishing right now. I mean, those guys, they don't care if it's a season or not. Those guys, we can't plan around those. We can't plan the world around the bad guys. We just need to take care of that. Are they there? Probably. Do we know? No. You know why? Because I'm not down there this morning. I'm down here. If I was down there and I saw them this morning, I'd make that phone call. So we can, us recreational guys, we do care. Like, we believe in the commission. That's why we're here. You guys are our advocates. Once again, we don't know where else to go. We're not allowed to talk to the tribes. They want to talk to governments only. So you're the government. So put in a word for us. We'd like to get this fishery back in some fashion. It seems that we keep losing more and more opportunity every year, and this is a simple fix. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, for a point of clarification from a guy from the east side. So what are you saying, that they cut out a cutthroat fishery you had under the guise that you...
Yes, the river, to protect the low returns of coho, as I understand this, the entire river shut down to all fishing.
Okay.
All fishing.
Okay.
Nobody's there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Kurt Kramer and Kerry.
Hello, Chairman, Director, rest of the commissioners. I don't have a whole lot to add to what Wayne said. I will go along with him. As I've been fishing for cutthroat and the Skagit for over 20 years, and again, I've never caught a salmon while fishing for cutthroat. Now, I have, and I'll admit, when the season was open, I'm a fly fisherman, but I'll take a bait caster out there and I'll toss a spoon towards the middle of the river trying to catch a silver, but only when it was open, and it was a completely different style of fishing. I could go down there this morning and go fishing, and I would have if the river was open. And the odds of me seeing another boat are pretty slim. And if I did, it would probably be Wayne or another one of our friends. There's just not a lot of us. I mean, maybe, you know, you might go down there and see a half dozen boats tops, but you're not going to do it now. It'll be a little later in the year when the fish actually start moving in. We just don't have an impact. We just don't catch salmon. So I don't see why that season is closed. Every year leading up to this last year and this year, if the salmon were closed, we could still fish for cutthroat or game fish. It makes no sense. The reasons that, you know, that are given for closing this season just doesn't hold water, in my opinion. And I'll say one other little thing about this. Because last year I knew there wasn't going to be a cutthroat season, although we did get to fish a little bit later in the year. And this year, when I know there is not going to be a cutthroat season, along with the fact that steelheading is closed on the river, I never bothered to buy a license. Those are the fisheries that I go after, and they're both shut down. One I understand, and the other I do not. Thank you.
Barry, Chaka, and Kurt.
Chairman, Commissioners, Director, Miranda. I told her before the meeting started that in my nearly 50 years of being around this commission, she was the best. Yeah. And I would add to what we heard this morning about you, to add adjectives: honest, open, and fair. And those are just huge values to have in our commission. I wish you the best, and I give you a big tip of the hat. Now on to the issue of the game fish closures in the Snoqualmie and Skagit River. How many times have you guys heard the question, how come we can't have more quality fishings? Or how come fishing isn't as good as it was in the old days? I want to talk about those fisheries and what it means to me. In the late 70s and early 80s, the then Department of Game made a major paradigm change in how they manage those fisheries. And by the late 80s, as an angler or as a professional biologist, I interacted with those anglers either on the river or at various sports clubs. I would hear fairly frequently...
Kurt, if I may interrupt you, why don't you establish your credentials for the new commissioners that don't know your history with the agency, et cetera? I think it'd be helpful.
I'm a retired Department of Fish and Wildlife employee. I was a fisheries biologist working for the state for 34 years. I worked almost exclusively in North Puget Sound, except for a few months when I started in the hatchery. I fished North Puget Sound rivers for since I was 2.5 years old. I'm now 70. I fished sea runs for over 50 years. I worked with the game fish extensively and have intimate familiarity with that resource, especially on the Skagit and the Snoqualmie, which I consider my home rivers. Back to the management change paradigm, by the middle and late 70s or 80s, I would hear from the anglers I dealt with that the fishing was as good as it was in the old days. How many times in the business I was in or with the public do you interact with, what do you hear that? The quality of that fishery has maintained itself for the until today, more than 30 years. It's still as good as it was in the old days, and the old days were in the 40s and 50s. The agency, by then it was the Department of Wildlife, adopted that management paradigm for the bull trout of the Skagit River, and lo and behold, we soon heard the fishing is as good as it was in the old days. That's the resource you got. You got a high-quality resource that actually has improved, and it's a management success story. And for somehow we value it so little that we closed. I'm really comfortable talking about numbers and stuff, and I think you got several emails from me that does exactly that. But I want to talk a little about what that fishery means to me. I fish a lot. The high point in my fishing calendar every year is the game fish seasons on the Snoqualmie and the Skagit. Probably 40% of the time that I fish, it's on those rivers, and it's for those game fish. It's a quality fishery. And I realize when thinking about these closures that those fisheries, to me, now is a chance to visit old friends. I get to fish the rivers, see how that resource that I invested so much in is doing, and what my rivers are doing, how they've changed, rivers I demand. It's a chance to go back and visit these old friends. And these game fish closures were a kick in the gut, and I realized that I had lost an old friend. It was the death of an old friend. And it was going to happen, before it happened in mid-July this year on the Skagit, I made a point to go visit and fish my old friend for the bull trout. And the bull trout, that early in the season, is a kind of an iffy fishery, but the reward can be really big. And that's some really, really nice fish. I fished it 4 days. I averaged about 5 hours a day on the river, hiked 3 to 5 miles every day while I was there. One day I fished all day and had one bite and caught one fish. But in total, in those 4 days of fishing, I caught one 13-inch bull trout. I caught 5 bull trout that were between 16 and 20 inches. I caught another 19 bull trout that were between 20 inches and 6 pounds. I caught 10 more bull trout that were between 7 and 10 pounds. And I caught 5 more bull trout that were between 10 and 12 pounds. How many fisheries do you have in the state where you have the absolute possibility of creating and meeting that kind of fisheries? It doesn't happen all the time, but in 25 years it's happened to me twice. That's a pretty unique fishery. I would call it world-class, especially if you put it on a river that's got 125 miles of main stem access with 20 public boat launches I don't have to pay for. And it's literally within an hour and a half to two-hour drive of more than 2.5 million fish, or fishermen, or potential fishermen. Where can you find a resource like it? How can we not value a resource like that? As I thought about best old friend I no longer get to fish with, I start to think about some of the old days, and I flash back to the fall of 2015. 2015 was the year that the coho disappeared, the pinks disappeared, and caused lots of these problems. I was fishing on the Sauk in late September and October, skating dry flies, or caddis, October caddis, and I was consistently in my 5 hours of fishing, and I'm getting older, so I only fish 4 or 5 hours a day now. I used to fish all the time. But I was catching 20 to 40 fish a day, all wild trout, not a hatchery involved, indigenous trout. Many of the fish were over 20 inches. In one pool, I caught a 20-inch rainbow, a 20-inch sea-run cutthroat, and a bull trout that was over 20 inches. They all came out of the same pool within 10 minutes of each other. What was interesting is they were in different parts of the pool and behaved differently, and we collected with a resource. The people that are going to protect our resource are the people that become passionate about the resource, and they do so by partaking in that resource on the waters. My question to you is, where is the next generation of those passionate advocates going to come from? I mean, who's going to replace Wayne and Kerry? I don't know. If we can't fish, it's not going to happen. If we don't have those advocates, you're not going to have a resource. Again, thank you for your time, and thank you for allowing me to vent. That's part of my grieving process about losing my old friend. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Commissioner Keough.
Yeah. Thank you,
Kurt. He'll be your new friend.
Yes. So I just need to know, and I appreciate I did read your well-written letter, and your passion is obvious. So, but I guess my question is more kind of, and forgive me, maybe you can educate me. So that the reason for these closures is because of the low coho and pink returns in the Skagit,
or in an email.
What's your understanding?
An email from the department that was kind of a generic email. There was basically seven reasons put forth about the closures, and I attempted to address each one in that last email. But the bottom line is it was the poor returns of my understanding. It was the poor return of coho and pinks, and the concerns of the tribes of non-compliance. Non-compliance seemed to be a big issue with the tribes. I've talked to several people in the tribal community that I have contacts with, some of which are sports fishermen, and that's really clear that they were concerned about non-compliance. And I can understand that, but it's not us that are doing the fishing that's in non-compliance. It's the poachers that do the non-compliance, and it's a problem in all of our fisheries. As I said in that email, if we're going to close fisheries for non-compliance, then let's start with Puget Sound crab. Let's start with tribal gooey duck fishing. There's as many problems in every one of our fisheries in non-compliance. You have the tools to address non-compliance, closing fisheries, reducing opportunities. And while the Skagit is you don't see many people. You've got 125 miles of river to be fishing on, and even if there's only one or two people per mile, or even 10 miles, that's a lot of fishermen over the course of 6 or 7 months that fishery is now closed.
Okay.
Lots of mandates and quality fishing.
And so just one follow-up question then. Was that, and I know you're an active participant in the North of Falcon, was this issue kind of vetted about, or this is different because this is a game fish then, right?
North of Falcon, as you know, for 11 years I served as a Puget Sound sports fish advisor and took parts in North of Falcon. And this is the first year that I wasn't an active advisor, in part because of my frustrations of the agencies and the manager's inability to proactively deal with some of these issues. And one of the issues that I was really obviously passionate about is these game fish seasons. And I made a point. I attended both the Mill Creek public meeting and the Linwood public meeting to look at this, and the agency didn't talk about the need to close game fish seasons at all. The only conversation was when I brought it up and said, what is your plans? And there was no answer to that. Ultimately, the decision was made to close those seasons basically in the last hours of the meetings in California, outside of the opportunity for publics to have any input. What's really frustrating is for the 50 years that I've been around game fish management, those kinds of closures have always came through public discussions through this body. And all of a sudden, that's not the thing. Is it the new policy that if we were interested in our game fish seasons, we have to go to North Falcon and we have to get our input into there? Is it the new policy that the agency is going to make those kinds of changes available to folks so we can react to it? Right now, people didn't know about these closures until after the fact. And that's a poor way to do business. You talk about the lack of credibility and support the agency got. I think you saw it when you requested a license increase. This is why. This is why you have trouble connecting with your users.
Just one follow-up. I understand your level of frustration, but, I mean, I'll just point out, though, for the fact, and you know this, Kurt, is that Skagit River this year in North of Falcon was, you know, one year it's Green River, one year it's another stock or river, but this year Skagit was the limiting factor. I mean, one of the most important limiting factors, which limited fisheries all the way from, out in Area 4 or 5, Moana Fuca. We have no commercial pink salmon opportunity in Skagit or Snohomish. I get it, but I understand your frustration in terms of maybe lack of correspondence, and in the fact that it's in California makes it even more difficult, but that's what we deal with. So, I just want to point that out, and so that, you know, other folks here in the room can appreciate kind of the complexity and the issues involved. That's
all. And I understand that, and what we've done in all those fisheries is we, the co-managers model the incidental impacts and stay within the criteria. My back of the envelope say on the Still Guamish that if you're allowed to cutthroat fishing we normally have, we probably were. In 2017, the non-treaty fisheries on the Still Guamish Coho got 21.3% of the total. If we had a cutthroat fishing, we probably would raise that to 21.5% or maybe 22%. That's nothing. I mean, if we're going to give it all to the tribes to support tribal fisheries, you got to be able to carve out a little place somewhere, can't we?
Mr. Kirkland.
Well, I'm pretty familiar with the fishery and the river. I was born about 100 yards from the Skagit River, just above the forks. And you guys haven't fished there very long. I fished there a long time, and so I'm familiar with it. And I understand what Bob's getting at. I mean, the overarching politics of this are difficult at best. But I can say categorically, and pass the red face test on it, this game fish fishery in the Skagit River for cutthroat or dolly varden, for example, those two species are pretty much what I was involved with for decades. It's a clean fishery. Where you fish, you are not impacting salmon. I don't think I've never caught a salmon fishing for cutthroat in my career of fishing there for 55 years. And Director, this is an issue about opportunity. And if we've got an issue with oversight of what goes on a system like this, then we have to have enforcement do their job. And I know they will if they are given the guidance to do it. But this is a fishery you need to experience as you're a fly fisherman. Unbelievable, unbelievable quality of water and quality of fish. I mean, you pull a 20-inch cutthroat. I haven't taken a fish home in 30 years. You can take two over 14 inches, but the most gorgeous fish that you've ever seen in your life. So I'll leave it at that. I hope we can fix this.
To make a comment on the incidental impacts, I do catch the odd coho when I'm fishing cutthroat. To be honest with you, I get maybe when I'm not targeting coho. When I target coho, I catch quite a few of them, even on my flies. But when I'm fishing cutthroat or bull trout, I catch, on the average, about one coho a year. And I fish a lot. I did the calculations. With a 10% hooking mortality, I'm catching somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 cutthroat for every coho that I kill. How many fisheries do we work with in North of Falcon that has that low of a bycatch? I encounter coho when I'm targeting game fish about 1/10 as frequently as I do when I'm targeting coho itself. And this is based on thousands and thousands of hours of fisheries, and I've caught tens of thousands of game fish out of those rivers.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate all that. And Brian, and with Crab and Perry.
Thank you, Commissioners, Director. First of all, I want to speak directly to Miranda. I want to echo the sentiments that we've all heard yesterday and today. I've received, through the petition comments, I've received literally hundreds of comments from sportsmen and women with accolades, with nothing but respect, admiration, and thankfulness for the job you've done, especially for championing the recreational fishermen and broadly our fisheries together. There's no plaque that I can give you from the hundreds of thousands of sportsmen and women from the state. You can't see them lined up, but believe me, they're standing right here with me. And we just want to say on behalf of all the sportsmen and women of this state, thank you. And there's probably a lot of free beer out there for you. On behalf of those sportsmen and women, the recreational fishermen, I come before you again. I just want to kind of speak about them to you. And I don't mean to lecture, but I just want to remind you, these guys and gals don't have a union. They don't have a lobby. Many of them belong to fishing groups that are for fun. These are hardworking. For the most part, they don't make three-digit incomes. They're your plumbers, your landscapers, the guys, the salt of the earth. And yet I remind you that they spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in the local economy and in buying licenses and supporting the fisheries, money that they earn through their sweat and blood. It's not an insignificant amount of money. And why? Why do they spend that money? Are they doing it because they expect some huge return of profit? No offense to our commercial fishermen, but I mean, that's a business. These guys spend money voluntarily for the simple joy of going out with their friends, with their children, with their grandchildren, and enjoying the sport that they grew up with through generations. Again, today, with the dwindling resources, they feel they're being marginalized. Honestly, we feel like we're getting the crumbs off the table. It looks to us, from our perspective, that we are the last consideration in a management of fisheries that looks like it's managed as a commodity and not as a resource. This state, we feel, could be a world-class fishing destination. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars could be coming into this state if the management of our fisheries was done for a recreational benefit and for tourist benefit and not parsed as it is today. They look towards you to be their voice and their advocate. The headlines in the news: foreign nation influences the democratic process. Huffington Post. Oh no, I'm sorry. It was the Olympian, and it actually read, sovereign nation influences the democratic process. Do you see where I'm going with this? The people, the salt of the earth, are tired. We've drawn a line in the sand and said, opening these meetings at the North of Falcon is the last straw. Having those meetings closed is the line in the sand. We're asking you to form a committee to address this issue and to communicate to your stakeholders. Please communicate that you're actually hearing them, that you're actually working on this. The wringing of hands, that we can't do anything about it, their sovereign nation, it's government to government, is not floating the boat on the river anymore. They're tired, they're done, they're losing interest, they're hopeless. They want to see some action taken to support their needs. Thank you.
Thank you. And Brian, you and the crabs.
Thank you. My name is Brian Allison. I represent the Puget Sound Crab Association. And I just kind of came here today to check in a little bit. And I guess I only had one real topic until the last gentleman spoke there. And I would just, I have to say, I disagree a little bit with some of the aspects there, specifically in the crab fishery with the new policy that was implemented in 2010. It is a recreational priority fishery. So, you know, from our perspective as commercial fishermen, you know, that priority means priority, and we actually get what's left over. So, while admittedly our share does come out, and get it in the end, it is a priority. So, actually, the biggest thing I wanted to ask primarily was if in the different talks and everything that have been going on, I know there's been a considerable amount of discussion about the accuracy of reporting for recreational crab fishery and that. And I know when Director Unsworth came aboard and that, we had a meeting over in Port Townsend and discussed a little bit there about the availability or the idea of instead of having a catch record card for the fishery, as to implementing a smartphone based GPS locating recording method there. And I'm just wondering if there's been any more talk about that or any progress on that, or do we have anything in the works or what? I just know that it's between the tribes and the commercial, and that it's a big point of contention that we that the numbers be accurate, I guess, in the reporting. From our perspective as commercial fishermen, the numbers that are taken, and we use a mathematical algorithm to run those numbers out to get what the actual recreational catch was, and in our opinion, we don't feel the accuracy is there, but that's all we have at the moment. So I'm just wondering if there is indeed anything in place or if there's been any work done on that. Can anybody answer that, Director? Do you have a...
We are working on electronic catch records.
And we'll probably could hear about that here in the presentations that are
sweet.
Coming up.
Sweet. All right. Very good. Well, that's pretty much all I had today. I just wanted to kind of touch base on that and see if there's any updated information.
Brian, we go through a process here. The commissioners can turn in blue sheets about a variety of things that they want to get briefings on and learn about. I've turned one in several months ago about catch accounting, and my request is for catch accounting of all fisheries across the board, because I think it's imperative that we know what's being caught by who and when. So we are working on that. The director's talking about the electronic catch accounting part, so we understand it. It's just going to take a little while to get it sorted out, but we know what you're talking about.
Okay, very good. Very good.
I remember even back when we did it in 2010, the noncompliance was about 30%. So, undersized.
Right. Yeah, there was a huge noncompliance issue there.
We did talk a lot then about education and initiatives and that. So. Okay.
Yep.
Good. Thanks, Brian.
All right. You bet.
And Joe, just a point of information. I went out on an enforcement boat out of Anacortes the other day, and some of your colleagues came in, and I just went over to see what they were catching. They were nice. They were all big ones, and they were full. So it was a good day for them that day. And I didn't take any home. Okay, that brings us in.